Welcome to What is Going Om, for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Humanity stands poised on the most important cusp of our 4 billion years of evolution. We can rise to a new level of consciousness and forge a vital path to the future, or we can face a crisis of epidemic proportions. The choice is ours. For everything we do today will affect many generations into the future. Those words were penned by globally recognized thought leader, evolutionary activist, speaker, healer, and writer on the intersection of personal and collective awakening, Dr. Anadia Judith, whose central vision is that our evolutionary challenge is to learn how to create heaven on earth. Reading the news headlines, observing the collapse of everything we grew up believing to be good and right, and the global rollback of women and girls' rights, one can't help wondering, is such a thing even possible? Dr. Anadia Judith holds a master's degree in clinical psychology and a doctorate in health and human services. Her studies in healing have included bioenergetics, psychotherapy, mythology, sociology, systems theory, mystic spirituality, and shamanism. She's the author of multiple best-selling books, including the beloved classics Wheels of Light and Eastern Body, Western Mind. Dr. Anadia Judith joins me now to discuss the evolutionary challenges we are facing and why women in particular must rise up to their leadership. Dr. Anadia Judith, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. What a beautiful introduction and what a beautiful laying out of the stakes that we are facing in the world right now.
Well, you've been a student of spirituality, psychology, and metaphysics since you were old enough to read. You've said that you were asking questions about the soul and why we're here at the age of three. And at 12 years old, you were being a therapist for your parents' dissolving marriage. You were teaching classes in yoga and meditation in your early 20s. I guess it's not surprising that with all you've accomplished since then, you're often called a prophet for our time. How does that make you feel?
Humbled, to tell you the truth. But I do feel it's amazing how little people think about the future. You know, I think it was the author Dave Ellis that said, most people spend more time planning their summer vacation than they do the rest of their lives, let alone humanity thinking about what we're creating here on this planet.
Well, I think you're right, but I also wonder how many people in the last 3 years have suddenly started thinking about the future and they can't see a way through. So many people are so anxious and afraid.
Yes, and I think that's because we are in the collapse phase of the curve of evolution that goes up and down over the eons, and that the current civilization, the current way we live, the current values that we place, the values of making money and having power and dominating, those values are collapsing and new ones are actually rising up underneath. But we are in the collapse phase of it. We're in the unraveling. And it's very hard to build something during that unraveling phase. But like a tooth that is wobbling because a new tooth is growing in, we see the instability, but there really is something new growing underneath, and it's everywhere.
Yes, and I think people are aware of it, but, you know, I always say that fear is in the waiting room.
Yes.
You know, when we're in that dentist chair, it's too late for fear, but right now we are still in that waiting room, and we are all afraid because, you know, the uncertainty is rather great.
And what people often do when they're in the waiting room is they distract themselves. They find something silly to read, or, you know, they've found that when you put a rabbit in a cage with a snake, the rabbit knows it's going to get eaten, but the snake might not do it right away. So they just kind of distract themselves with taking a bath. And, you know, and I think humanity right now is just, we're very lost in distractions at a time when we most desperately need to be awake. You know, Rumi said, be careful, we're at the edge of the roof and you're drunk. And, you know, so it's this time to be careful because we are at the edge of a free fall, and we are not sober, we are not awake, we are not present, we are not speaking truth, and we need to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to talk about your latest work, She Rises, today, but before we do, I want to track back a little bit and talk about your book, which is a double award-winning book, The Global Heart Awakens, because this will help us lay down a little bit of a pathway from there to She Rises. And the subtitle of that book, The Global Heart Awakens, is very, very important in this conversation, because it is humanity's rite of passage from the love of power to the power of love. So first of all, tell me about She Rises. Sorry, before we do that, let's go back to the global, that particular book was awarded the 2007 Nautilus Book Award for the best book of the year for social change. And in it, you posit that modern society is an adolescent culture driven by greed and power, facing an evolutionary challenge. And that evolutionary challenge is a rite of passion from the love of power to the power of love. Your vision of catalyzing social change and creating heaven on earth depends on our ability to successfully navigate that rite of passage into adulthood that is facing us. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, I put in that book a schema of child development onto history, that we were birthed from the womb of nature. And in the Paleolithic, we lived close to the earth. We traveled in small tribes. We lived in caves. We were infants in our cultural evolution. And then as we gained the power to plant the seed and we developed agriculture and farming, we grew up a little bit. We grew up into our toddlerhood. We still couldn't read and write. We didn't have science or technology. We didn't have any of the things we take for granted today. But we had a little more power over our lives. We could stay still and build settlements and temples and complexes, and we had division of labor. So humanity was starting to grow up. And then as population expanded and we started running into each other, different tribes with different languages and different gods, you know, wars started to break out. And we came into our period of what I call sibling rivalry. Right. And mostly, you know, the men were drafted into that while the women were protecting their young. And so men got militarized and the women were taking the job of, you know, feeding and caring for the children and staying safe. And we've been in that stage for about 5,000 years. But we've been growing up all this time. At the beginning of that stage, hardly anyone could read or write. We didn't have science. We were very primitive still. And we have learned to read and write. We have scientific discoveries that help us understand the world. We have technology. We have cars and airplanes and computers and the internet. Humanity has been growing up all this time. And we are now at what I call our adolescence. And, you know, I raised four kids, three stepchildren and one of my own, took them all through adolescence. And adolescents are very self-centered. They're very concerned about their ego. How do I look? How am I doing? They're very concerned about whether they're liked or not liked. Look at what we do on Facebook. Yes, I like this. I don't. How many likes did I get on that post? And they're very, they don't see the bigger picture yet. And this is right where we are as a species. Also, adolescents grow incredibly. You know, they have a growth spurt. A boy can grow a foot in a year. And then they stop growing physically. And that is the time to grow intellectually, to grow spiritually, to expand, but our physical growth stops. So in population, you know, when I was born, population was about 3 billion. And now we're at 8 billion. So we've been growing exponentially, but we are actually, it's starting to slow down. You know, some populations in some countries are leveling off. And this is all part of the adolescent physical growth stopping and turning toward our intellectual and spiritual growth. But we have to face an initiation because humanity doesn't change unless they have to. And so the aspects of our initiation are climate change, you know, economic collapse, you know, all the unraveling that we see happening. They are initiating us to a different way of living, to a reorganization. And what I say is that we have been organized by a top-down power over model. Someone on top tells the people underneath them what to do, and they tell the people underneath them what to do, and on it goes. And that has been our model for 5,000 years, appropriate for a parent to tell a child what to do when the child is 5 years old, you know, or 7 years old. Not so appropriate when the child is a teenager, and yet we're not quite mature yet. So this organizing structure has worked for humanity for a long time, but it sacrifices the intelligence of everyone, and it is not terribly efficient, actually. We can come to a higher organizing principle that I say is the power of love, based on more cooperative organizing, more egalitarian organizing, more compassion, more diversity, more inclusiveness, more peer-to-peer. We see a lot of things like, you know, that economic models are peer-to-peer, they're cutting out the top-down and they work just fine. And so for the first time in history, we are starting to be able to choose what we love. For the first time, we can choose to live where we want to live. We can choose to marry whom we want to marry in most cultures, not everywhere, of course. We can choose the profession we want to go into. We don't have to go into our parents' profession. So we're starting to select for love. And that is, what do we want the world to be? How can we create heaven on earth here with what we're given? It's entirely possible. We just don't have that as a model. And so I ask, what is humanity's purpose? Why did Gaia create humans with opposable thumbs and four brains? What is our evolutionary purpose here on this planet at this time? And I believe it's to learn how to create heaven on earth.
How would you define heaven on earth?
Well, I think it's a co-creative process with divine intelligence that, you know, we've seen ourselves as children of God. Now it's time to become adults of God. And adults don't just follow orders. They co-create, they collaborate, they talk about it, they create. And so a co-creation with divine guidance, where we are actually taking power, but not with a kind of hubris that we are the gods and we can do anything we want, but with a guidance. That is, we have a humility, and yet we also see that we have the power to change the gene pool. We have the power to blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons. We have the power to change the climate worldwide. This is the power of gods, but we don't yet have the maturity to manage any of these things wisely. And that's what the initiation is for, to bring the maturity in, which is what we don't have the maturity to match our technology. So heaven on earth is really, it is a world of beauty. And, you know, I've worked with the chakras a lot in my life. So if I just take the chakras, it's a world ruled by wisdom and higher guidance. It is a world of beauty. I mean, we should be walking out our door and seeing beauty everywhere we look. That's what we should be creating. It is a world of creativity and truth. It is a world based on love, where people are cared for and supported. And that's how we get the best out of them. It is a world where people feel empowered, not disempowered. It is a world where pleasure and, you know, and that's also part of beauty, but where we feel pleasure, we feel good in our lives, and a world in which the planet is taken care of. And so that goes right down the chakras, 7654321, with the values of the chakras applied to a global society. And I think if we hit on every one of those notes, we have a good formula for beginning the vision of what kind of world we want to create. Now, the devil's in the details, of course.
Mm, yeah. Do you think that we, you know, in our evolutionary, on our evolutionary path, when we stopped valuing women and the role, the partnership role that women played, is, you know, when we were hunter-gatherers, everything started to go one-sided.
Yes.
And, you know, begin to devolve, really, not evolve.
Exactly. Well, it was part of the evolution and of the evolutionary spiral, you know, that keeps going. And sometimes it goes down before it goes up. Sometimes, like I say, there's an unraveling before something new can be created. And in this, you know, in the book, in the flow of the book, I talk about four aspects of a Jungian paradigm that can be applied to culture. And if I can briefly talk about those, the first one is the static feminine. And that is in the individual's life, an infant whose whole life is the mother. You know, the infant can't be very far away from the mother and still survive. So that's the whole world. And that's where we were in the Paleolithic. The whole nature was everything. We were fused with nature in a kind of symbiosis. And we didn't have much freedom. We didn't travel very far. We didn't have electric lights to turn on when it was dark. We couldn't turn on the furnace when it was cold. You know, we were limited by that. So it's nurturing, but it's limited. The next one is the dynamic masculine, which is where the masculine rises up, overthrows the mother, and establishes a new direction. And really stands on the dead body of the mother. And there's many myths in history that are exactly about that, and creates a new order. And with that, there's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of fighting. It's a very immature takeover. It's like what we see in many places where, you know, some faction is trying to take over. I mean, we even see this in the US where, you know, ideologues are trying to take over the government. They don't know anything about it. You know, it's very immature. So there was a lot of chaos that followed. And what stepped in, because the masculine had gotten control by then and established their gods and established their hierarchical top-down order, is that they instituted what then became the static masculine to keep the power that they had gained. And the static masculine is law and order. It's the intellect that can separate this from that and tease apart subtle distinctions and categorize every plant in the universe and yet not be able to save them. You know, it's rigor and logic and control, but in a little more peaceful way, less chaotic. It's more stable. And so we gained a stability. Now, this would be, you know, the Christian era, for example, when there was a lot of conformity, there was one God, everyone had to submit to that. And that conformity enabled some more maturity. That was the time when we learned to read and write. And that was the scientific revolution of the Enlightenment period. And so we went through that. Now we're missing one, which is the dynamic feminine. And that's the one that is coming now. The dynamic feminine breaks down the static of the masculine, and there's symbols for each of these. The dynamic feminine is the spiral. The static feminine is the circle. The circle is enclosed and limited. The dynamic masculine is the symbol for the male, the arrow branching out from the circle. The static masculine, that's the dynamic masculine. The static masculine is the cross. It separates above from below, left from right, masculine from feminine, and it gives a stability. The dynamic feminine is the spiral. It starts at the heart of the cross, and it comes out, and it breaks down those separations in an expanding spiral that is inclusive and yet evolving. So the dynamic feminine is seen more in, you know, in women holding circles rather than sitting in rows in pews, watching a pastor preach in front of the congregation. It is creativity, it's nonlinear dynamics and science. It's a more egalitarian, more collaborative, cooperative, co-creative paradigm. And it has more freedom to create. And so it's not that these will dominate the other. What we need is all four. Yes. We need all working in balance. There's times we need the static masculine. We need the intellectual rigor. We need the laws in order to keep a society peaceful. There's times we need to overthrow something that has outlived its purpose. There's times we need the static stability of the static feminine, the circle, the nurturing mother. And there's times we need to break that up into a new creative cycle. So we're finally at the point where we can have all four of these in balance. And the dynamic feminine, the newest one, is still immature. It hasn't become the mainstream yet, but you see it rising up at the edges everywhere.
Mm. So when did the inspiration for She Rises, for the card deck that you've created, when did that, come into the picture for you?
Well, I spent 25 years teaching workshops all over the world. And I was on a plane once or twice a month and, flying everywhere. And that was my life. And I loved it. And I had written some of my books along the way. And then the pandemic came along and all that stopped. All the places I was teaching were closed. There were no live events. And I got to be home for a few years. And I loved it. But my creativity can't be kept down. And so that was when the She Rises came through me. But part of the inspiration, it had been for a long time I had studied archetypes, and especially archetypes of the feminine. And when Hillary Clinton was running for president in the US, a highly qualified woman, and I'm quite the news reader, and I would read the comments about her. Her hemline was too short or too long, or what happened to her hair this time, or her voice was too brassy, or she was too assertive, or she was too soft and feminine to be commander in chief, or all of these comments. And, I don't want to say about who was elected in her place, but we lost a very good leader because people could not get their heads around a woman leading in that role. Now, we know other countries have it, but the U.S. is a little more patriarchal than some and less than others. And so I realized women lead differently than men, and they need different archetypes to guide their leadership. I had been teaching courses on leadership, and, it wasn't drawing the women in because I used the word leadership. And when I talked to people, they said, oh, yeah, I saw that you were offering that. But, leadership is something that I don't really relate to. It's something that men do. They might not say that out loud, but it's command and control and being on top. And they go, I'm just not like that. And yet I saw that these women were leading in their lives in many different ways. Even yoga teachers, they're leading people on a spiritual journey. Counselors are leading people on a healing journey. Divas are breaking the bounds of what a woman can be by being outrageous on stage and full of life and creativity. And so I began to outline these archetypes of leadership that are profoundly feminine, and not feminine in the sweet, docile, submissive way, but profoundly woman-centered. And some of them are old and have been lost, like the priestess. The priestesses were once some of the most respected members of society. Yes. The oracles, the oracle at Delphi, kings and generals and wars were started or ended according to what the oracle said. People would travel in 8th century BC hundreds of miles to come consult the oracle. They were some of the respected women. How many oracles do you know? How many people do we go to? Well, maybe tarot card readers. And so some of these were ancient archetypes that had been lost. Some of them are archetypes that are just emerging, like the activist, the trailblazer, the diva, really. These are more modern archetypes. And then some of them are archetypes that have always been here, but we take them for granted, like the maiden, mother, crone, which is how the goddess is seen in her triple aspect, you know, and mothers are taken for granted. And we overlook the older women, you know, because they're no longer childbearing or attractive and they don't have anything to offer, but they have tremendous wisdom from their years of life. So by doing these archetypes, women can recognize them in themselves, and hopefully men can begin to recognize them in the women they work with. Understanding, for example, that the shepherdess on their team that makes sure everybody gets the meeting notes and everybody has enough water to drink and everyone's cared for, she's an important role on any team and should be recognized as such. But she doesn't lead from the front.
No. And so many women who think that they are not leaders, quite often you will find that you ask the husband anything domestic, and he'll always say, ask my wife. Yes. That's her, you know, and he may be saying it in a derogatory manner that, you know, that's her domain, but that's her domain. She is leading in those arenas. And women do not give themselves enough credit for that.
No, they don't. Even the word economics came from care of the home, and it was a woman's domain. How did they balance, you know, buying the food and clothing the children? And how do they balance all these things? And that's really the root of economics.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, I really want to dive into the archetypes, learn more about them, and how understanding the archetypes, you know, can help us bring about social change. So you're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is globally recognized thought leader, evolutionary activist, best-selling author, and acknowledged prophet for our time, Dr. Anadia Judith. And we're talking about the critical role that women play in helping society and humanity move beyond its adolescence, rise to a new level of consciousness, and forge a vital path to the future. We'll be back with more in a few moments.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor, and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked what's really worth reading and what's not. So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who have walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees, and no BS, just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers, plus free book excerpts, audios, and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo, and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club? Get inspired and save money at the No BS Spiritual Book Club.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Dr. Anadia Judith, you say that without women's influence, the values that are destroying our planet are unlikely to change. Where do we begin to help women understand how much influence they have?
Well, we look at the rise of women's liberation, and a lot of that has been giving women the option to behave more like men, to go into the man's world, to make money, to hold positions of power. And we've made strides in that. There's a long way to go still, but we have made progress in that. But what is missing is the feminine contribution to the global conversation about who we are and where we're going. And as long as that's being decided mostly by men, it'll be based on the patriarchal values that have really been the pillar of our current society. And those patriarchal values are very limited. They're top down, they're power over, they disempower people. They came at a time when the planet was ours for the taking, and there was plenty of everything. Now there's not plenty of everything. So these values of how we build a society have to change. And women have been the builders of relationships. Women know how to do that. They know how to take care of people. They take care of their children. Women carry the beauty. We want to, you know, men can just show up for an interview any way they want to look. And we have to, you know, look at how we dress and what colors we're wearing. And, you know, women contribute the beauty. So when we talk about the kind of world we want to create, it's got to be created by men and women together in partnership. And that means as many women in leadership positions. But the progress hasn't been made in leadership. It's been made in, you know, the lower level jobs. The women's workforce is about 55% of the workforce, 35% of the leadership. So that tells you something right there.
Yeah. Well, the second side of the question that I asked you is, how do we convince the men that it's time to start valuing the women? I mean, just today, you know, we exchanged a comment before we went on air. Your newsfeed and mine, you're in America, I'm in England, today was all about the decision that is being taken by some Baptist churches to do away with the women pastors.
Because the men are threatened. Yeah. And there was another article today about how they're still burning women in India who, you know, for their dowries, you know. Just incredible that these things are happening in the modern age. I think the first step, when you say, how do we do this, is to stop making men wrong. Men have inherited the same paradigm that we have, and there are things that limit men as well in that paradigm, and they have a lot of burden on them to produce, to be right, to know where to go. That's a difficult job in an uncertain world that is changing rapidly. I mean, we just can't operate from that principle anymore. And so to stop making men wrong and instead say, look at what can be contributed that can take some of the burden off your shoulders. We want to co-create with you. Let's talk about what the outcome really we want. Do you really want a war that is costing money and lives and destroying buildings and hospitals and has to be rebuilt? Is that really what we want? No, I don't have any, you know, illusion that I'm going to go call up Vladimir Putin and have a talk with him. But it is really when the paradigm in the world gets so strong that it overthrows the other, it overcomes it, really. And what we're finding in research is that, for example, when women are part of the International Peace Accord or any peace accord, the peace lasts longer. It's more willingly adapted by the people because she comes from a representation of the people. Only one woman has ever signed an international peace accord, and that's Miriam Colonel Ferrer from the Philippines. Studies have shown that women, when there's more women on the boards of directors or as CEOs in companies, the companies have better stock performance, they have lower employee turnover, and they perform better overall. I mean, this is statistics. So we can show to these men, look, when you have, it doesn't mean the men have to get off the board, but when you have more of a 50% equality of women on the board of directors, this is what happens. Yet, in the top 500, Fortune 500 companies, only 7% have women CEOs.
So tell me more about how archetypes can help us. And also tell me a little bit about some of the ancient and the modern archetypes, different examples of them.
Well, archetypes are like blueprints. You know, they are conceptual, but they have a life of their own when we enact them. I found when I was working on this project that an archetype would wake me up in a dream in the middle of the night and say, I need to be in your deck. Go downstairs and write me right now. And here's what I want to say. I mean, it was like someone whispering in my ear and grabbing me by the scruff of the neck. And when they become enacted, I have women read these evocations of the archetype, which is on each card. It's an I voice. It's the archetype speaking directly. That something happens within them. They shake, they cry, they laugh, they feel seen for the first time in their lives. For instance, one archetype of the shamana, the female shaman, was read by a woman in one of my workshops. And she said, for 45 years, I've never seen anyone describe me and understand me so completely as being this archetype. So much so that when I did the live performance for my 70th birthday, she flew all the way from Maine across the country to California to perform the shamana in the show. I talked about the shepherdess, who is caring for people and making sure everyone's included. And, you know, in the classroom, she might be seeing the struggling student and trying to bring that student into the fold, or the one that's left out of the party and brings them in. One woman said, oh my goodness, I've been doing this all my life. I never knew what to call it. And I never realized that I was really offering something valuable. She felt seen and honored. Now, I've had men come to these circles as well in these workshops, and I just did a live workshop on this and of training people to facilitate these circles, and a man came, and he said he felt like he wants to take this into the corporate world, where he works as a scientist in precious metals, and show the men what these archetypes are so they can begin to honor them and recognize them, and he wants to do it with his daughters. You know, how great is that? Yeah. So by enacting it is how we awaken it. And when women can see themselves as making a contribution, which I think we all really want to do, we want to make a contribution, but one that fits their intrinsic nature, then the value is, it's value added. And I think when the men see the value added and some of the pressure off their shoulders, then there can be more acceptance of this.
You also write about honoring the stages of a woman's life, the maiden, mother, and crone. It's interesting that we are seeing a number of well-known actresses, you know, past their 50s, suddenly feeling that they can allow grey hair to be seen. And they're getting a lot of praise for it. I wonder, we don't yet know, how that is going to affect the roles that they start to get offered and whether they will remain, you know, keen to keep the gray hair or not.
And what permission that gives to the average person. You know, in the patriarchal culture, the women are supposed to stay like maidens. That means lifelong, we're supposed to have the figure of a 22-year-old. And we're supposed to have the fair skin and the sexy body and this, you know, all of that lifelong. And you don't get it, you know, until recently, you don't get a part in a movie unless you look that type, even if you're 50 or 60. And of course, we know women have been starving themselves and doing surgery on their bodies and everything to try to fit that. But when the different stages of a woman's life are valued, we realize that the mother represents the prime of a woman's life. Not the maiden, she's the fresh, uncooked promise, but the mother is the prime of a woman's life. It's her productive period. It's you know, when she really shines. And the crone is the wisdom of the woman who has lived honored through the prime of her life and has gathered some power on a spiritual and intellectual level that is valuable. Her insight from the years that she has lived has a great deal to contribute.
So how does the deck actually work? Apart from, you know, informing people about the archetype so that one can begin to, you know, understand one's own archetype or several archetypes. You know, how can you use this deck to help women rise up into leadership?
Yes, well, I realized it wasn't in the cards themselves, but in the enactment. And at first I was thinking like, you know, some cards and then a little book that describes each card like you have for so many tarot decks. And then I realized that what I wanted was to have women, you know, come into a circle, for example, pick a card, be able to take it back to their seat and read about the card and not have everybody take turn to read the book. So I put all the writing. Here's a card. It's a, like the size of a large greeting card. This is the spinner. She begins the whole deck. She's the first of the three fates. And inside, I have written each archetype from the I voice. Let's see. The I voice, which is the spinner, you know, I am the spinner, the cosmic beginner. It is here we begin, and here that I spin life from the dust of the stars. And it goes on. So it's in the I voice. Then I write about the she voice, and the she is the intellectual information about that archetype. It tells about how her name was Clotho in the Greeks because she spun the thread that they wove the cloth, and she was invoked at the birth of a baby to have a nice long life, and how the three fates are always in every Greek play and every endeavor. So that's the intellectual knowlede either about that archetype's history or her standing in the world. You know, like on The Peacemaker, I talk about how women haven't signed peace accords and yet peace lasts longer. And then the you is the back of the card. And that is when you work with this card, she is asking you, so begin your journey with the spinner and she will take you straight to the source, because that source is the endless creative possibility that is still raw and unformed. So it encourages women to begin. You know, the spinner begins with the barest thread, the barest idea, but that's how everything starts. So, you know, how to, if you are looking for a new beginning, appeal to the spinner, who is the origin of anything that has life. So it's an archetype to work with. And when I teach, I say, pick an archetype that would be your home base, which is similar to what you are. Oh, yes, I'm that. I'm a spinner. I'm a creatrix. I'm a mother right now. I'm a dancer, I'm a athlete, I'm a observer. These are some of the archetypes. And carry the card with you for a week. Memorize the I poem, speak it into the mirror and feel it awaken something in you. And people tell me things change in their life. When I did my live performance, a friend of mine who I see as a kind of empress, she handles a lot of things. I asked her to be the empress and she came and did the performance. And she told me after, she said, my life up-leveled after that. I really am becoming the empress in a way that I wasn't before, from having memorized this and acted it out on stage and really stepped into the role and claimed that that's what she was doing.
It seems to me, going back to that man who joined your circle and said he wanted to take it into the corporate arena, that you should be doing a deck for men as well.
I have it all planned out. Yes.
You do? Yeah. Good. Because I think that would be really interesting, you know, in a corporate, you know, arena, to be a setting, to be able to have the women look at theirs and the men look at theirs. And some of them are going to cross because men can be shepherds too.
Yes, they can. And men can be lovers. You know, a lover is an archetype. And, you know, men can be fathers and women mothers. You know, there are and men are creators, just as women is the creatrix. Yes. I have one. I've outlined and named, you know, 38 to 40 archetypes for men that I would do. Right now, I'm too busy getting this off the ground to take another project. And I'm in the middle of writing another book. So, but it's on the list. It's on the list and it's in conception.
Have you actually done anything more with men in circles?
Well, several men have come to the circles and they've had profound reactions and awakenings from it. One man, for example, picked the empath card. The empath is an archetype. And he said, I picked this because I'm just very out of touch with my feelings. I'm one of those guys that doesn't have much emotion. And he started reading it out loud. He got halfway through it and he was bawling his eyes out. He couldn't even finish reading because it triggered some emotional connection in him that had been dormant. So I find men can have often a profound result. And I tell the men, here's three ways to look at it. You can change the pronoun to he if you want to, and that's fine. You can look at it as a feminine part of yourself that has not been allowed to awaken, which is my favorite way. Or you can look at it as this is, you know, what women in your life embody this archetype, and how can you see that in your wife, in your daughter, in your coworker? And those are three ways that men can deal with this. And I think it's really good for men to embrace a different set of archetypes.
Well, I think you've said before that, you know, we need to move beyond duality of masculine and feminine into wholeness.
Yes.
And I think this would be a very good way to, non-threatening way to begin, you know, to show people how to do that.
Well, we're trying to birth a new world, and we don't have birth without the woman being part of it. And the conception is masculine and feminine together. I mean, that's how our biology works. And the woman then brings it into birth. She puts the flesh on the bone, so to speak. And if we're going to birth a new world, women have to be part of it. We need a divine mother and divine father so that we can be the divine child. And the divine child has powers beyond either of its parents to create something new.
You know, I was at the Sister Giant conference in 2017, and Bernie Sanders was the keynote speaker, and it was organized and led by Marianne Williamson. And part of the whole conference was about persuading more women to take roles in politics, whether it's, you know, PTA, local council, governor, whatever level it is. You know, the call was, more women should stand up. And many women, you know, said they wanted to. And I do believe that that was quite successful in bringing forth many women who did step up. But it seemed to me, I didn't hear anything there about archetypes. I didn't hear anything about, you know, looking at the different archetype and, you know, where can you play a role that fits your archetype?
Well, the reason you saw me looking down is I was looking for my stateswoman card, because that is an archetype. Yes, I think that this is a knowledge that is not currently very available. I mean, we don't have archetypal psychology much in the culture. And yet, you know, what we have instead is stereotypes, you know?
Yes.
And stereotypes are a them, they are an other, they have no depth, they have no shadow side, you know, and they don't bring the richness, they don't have a story, and we can't really relate to them. Archetypes give us something to step into to grow larger.
This is something really that they should teach in schools, because, you know, kids are learning how to do certain things, and all of the subjects are very, you know, academic and intellectual. Nobody is telling them how to be.
No, that's right. Something. That's right. And that's where we're really missing. And that really is more the feminine contribution. The static masculine was, you have to learn your mathematics, and you have to learn your history and all that. And that stuff is important. But that's all we learn in school. We don't learn how to get along with each other. We don't learn how to talk about what we feel. We don't learn how to dream and create. We don't learn how to question. You know, we're not supposed to question authority. And then we have conspiracy theories come along and nobody questions it, and they take it hook, line, and sinker. We're not learning to think for ourselves. So education needs to change radically. Yeah.
How confident are you that we will, you know, take this pathway and we will be able to create heaven on earth?
I think it's a very long arc. I think that it goes downhill before the path goes uphill to the top of the mountain. But I think that is the arc of evolution. I think evolution is always recreating itself at higher levels of organization. So our next level of organization, from being, you know, from villages to towns to cities to countries, is a global unity. And that is the next stage for humanity. That will be the beginning of our planetary adulthood. that we recognize ourselves as a global civilization, and that we have to, everything, you know, what happens, the fire's burning in Canada, we're bringing smoke to Washington, D.C. in the Midwest. I was back east when it happened. It was terrible. It was like being in California. We are one planet. You know, the virus was everywhere on the planet within a few weeks. We are one planet. So this is part of our global awakening. And when we can do that peacefully and well, we are on our way. And I think it's just the inevitable movement of evolution, that women will rise eventually, no matter how much they're held down, is inevitable, that we are going towards a diversity, a plural culture with many ways and many races and many different expressions. That's not stoppable. People can try to stop it, but that's what we are. That's what is true. So I think that I have a positive and hopeful belief in the long run, and I know the short run is going to be difficult and tragic for many.
Yeah. You have started the She Rises movement. Tell me about the movement.
Well, the movement is to get women to awaken to these archetypes. So I'm training people to lead these, what I call empowerment circles, where women get introduced to the archetype and they read one. I did find a stateswoman, by the way. Here she is. and then training them to lead, that will be the She Rises leadership circle of people leading this and being trained to have deeper knowledge of the archetypes and how to coach women to really step into it powerfully. And then the She Rises visionary circle will people that want to take it into live events, more creative places. Last week, someone wanted to take it to the Girl Scouts, and we're going to make a patch for the Girl Scouts to sew on their badges. And there's lots of creativity coming into this of places we can take it. Women are excited and they have new ideas. And I'm like, yeah, go for it. Let this morph, let this evolve beyond what I can conceive of myself. That's how it has the power, into a movement of women supporting each other, men recognizing them, women working together with men, co-creatively, with equal respect and equal power and equal pay.
Yes. Yeah. So are men, you know, welcome to be a part of this movement?
Absolutely. They are invited and welcome to be part. And I encourage people. Some people have talked about using it with couples.
You know, I think that would be
what would you like to see, what do you see in your wife? What would you like to see more of? What feminine characteristic would you like your husband to incorporate more? Or, you know, obviously with gay couples, the men are reclaiming their feminine and the women see it in each other. It doesn't have to be limited to heterosexual couples, but yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So you also created Sacred Centers. Before we close, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Sacred Centers was the name of my business that was teaching the world about the chakra system. And the centers in the body, the chakras are sacred centers, but it has many meanings to me. One, that if we are centered in the sacred, and that is the center of everything we do, there is a sanctity to it. There is something that is very healing and profound and meaningful when we do that. And so I like to bring the sacred into everything I do. Every workshop starts with a simple ritual of how people check in and join together and the agreements we make and make a sacred container. And when I do the She Rises circles, I have candles and music and flowers and things that we are walking into a feminine field that without any words, you can feel it. So that the sacred is the center of all that I'm about. And the sacred centers are the chakras in the body.
Mm. You have written so many books. I think you've had a million books in print, not a million individual books, but millions of copies, and more than two dozen languages. What would you most like to be remembered for?
Oh, what a great question, Sandy. I think I would most like to be remembered as a visionary that inspired people to a possibility that they didn't know existed and create that possibility.
And that, you know, that premise obviously runs right through everything you've ever done.
Yes.
And all of your books.
It does.
Yeah. Nice way of parceling it all together.
Yes. Wonderful question. Now I'll think about that more.
Yeah. Because I mean, I know you are very well known, very very much appreciated for your work with the chakras. You know, I think it's gold standard work. But this work with the feminine too, I think it's so much off the time that I wouldn't mind betting that that's going to be quite big.
Oh, I hope so. And I hope it goes beyond me, you know?
Yes.
I didn't even plan to do that. It wasn't part of my, you know, so-called branding with the chakras or what I'd been teaching, but it's what came through me. And so I just said yes to it.
Well, thank you. Glad that you did. Dr. Anadia Judith, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. It's really a pleasure.
She Rises, Awakening Our Female Archetypes of Leadership card deck is available in both physical and digital formats from SheRisesMovement.com. And you can get more information about Dr. Anadia Judith's workshops, books, and events at AnadiaJudith.com. And you can also look at SacredCenters.com. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back with another edition of What Is Going On at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me and a heartfelt thank you again to Anadia Judith.
Namaste.